From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air.
Help, I need somebody. Help, not just anybody. Help, you know I need someone. Help. When I was younger, so much younger than today.
Paul McCartney, George Harrison, and Ringo Starr have reunited for a Beatles documentary that will be broadcast later this month on ABC TV. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, Ringo Starr talks about his life before, during, and after the Beatles. Ringo Starr, coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The Labor Department says the jobless rate last month dipped a tenth of a percent to 5.5%. It's the lowest reading in 7 months. Some analysts suggest this could mean that the Federal Reserve won't cut interest rates again this year since more people are working. But other analysts disagree. They believe the Fed will trim rates one more time, perhaps in December. Labor Secretary Robert Reich calls today's unemployment numbers, quote, steady as she goes. Congressional Democratic leaders are pleased by a new Wall Street Journal poll. It indicates that the Republicans' popularity is dropping. UPI's Pi Chamberlain prepared this report.
The poll shows positive views of Republicans of only 40%, the lowest since the last election. Speaker Gingrich is at his lowest point, too, and by a margin of more than 2-1, those polled said they worried about what Republicans in Congress would do. Senate Democratic Leader Daschle says the numbers reflect the personal contacts he has had.
People are increasingly concerned. What they now know is that this whole debate has been between the extreme and the more extreme.
Republicans say the numbers will turn around if and when they pass a balanced budget, something the polls suggest the voters don't believe is possible. Pi Chamberlain, Capitol Hill.
French investigators have found evidence that terrorists who've been planting bombs in France have received help from Islamic militants in other European countries. Early yesterday, French police arrested several key suspects who were planning an attack in northern France. From Paris, Lynn Terry reports.
Police arrested five people they suspect are directly linked to the spate of bombings since July, which have killed seven people and injured about 160. In one apartment, police found the makings of a bomb and evidence that the terrorists are linked to an Islamic militant in London. Terrorist experts say that man supplied the group with money. They say there are also networks in Germany and Belgium, and perhaps several more terrorist cells in France. Investigators believe the attacks were ordered by a hardline Islamic group in Algeria, which is angry about French support for the military regime in Algiers. The government fears the group could try to stage more attacks. It's maintaining tight security throughout the country. For National Public Radio, I'm Lynn Terry in Paris.
Russian President Boris Yeltsin appeared on national television today, the first time he's done so since being hospitalized last week with heart trouble. He told reporters he was feeling not bad. The Russian leader was dressed in a white tracksuit, but he sounded weak and his voice was slightly slurred as he talked with Prime Minister Viktor Chernomyrdin. He told the Prime Minister that his team of doctors meets twice a day to assess his condition. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 9 points at 4,817 in active trading. The Nasdaq is up 4.5 points at 1,061. This is NPR. The National Basketball Association opens its regular season tonight with games in the United States and Canada. The Vancouver Grizzlies and the Toronto Raptors are the newest additions to the league and the first NBA teams in Canada since 1947. NPR's Tom Goldman reports.
Vancouver and Toronto are cities known more for their devotion to hockey than for basketball, but actually basketball does have roots in Canada. James Naismith, who invented the game, was Canadian-born, and pro basketball's first game was played in Toronto 49 years ago. Neither Vancouver nor Toronto are expected to challenge two-time defending champion Houston for the NBA title. Last year's NBA finalist Orlando is a legitimate contender, even though center Shaquille O'Neal is sidelined returned with a broken thumb. Chicago should do well if superstar Michael Jordan can coexist with his newest teammate, the man with the painted hair and body tattoos, Dennis Rodman. The NBA opens its season with players and owners at peace. The two sides survived a summer contract dispute and reached a six-year labor agreement. I'm Tom Goldman reporting.
Conservative groups are criticizing Republican plans to reduce Medicare. A dozen organizations got together today to say the Senate's proposed plan would ration health care for the elderly and force seniors into health plans they don't want. A spokesman for the Cato Institute says the Senate must restore the medical savings account option to the legislation. The savings account would combine a private catastrophic health insurance plan with a personal savings account funded by Medicare. The Indiana governor's office and Toyota say there is no deal yet on a possible third Toyota assembly plant in the state. The automaker and Governor Evan Bayh say it's too early to say an agreement has been reached. But their comments come after a Japanese business paper reported a deal was struck and will be signed next month. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR, in Washington.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
I'm Ringo, and I play the drums.
I'm Paul, and I play the bass.
I'm George, and I play a guitar.
I'm John, and I too play a guitar. Sometimes I play the fool.
There can never be a real Beatles reunion, not with John Lennon dead. But Paul McCartney, George Harrison, and my guest Ringo Starr reunited for a documentary called The Beatles Anthology that will be broadcast over three nights on ABC TV beginning November 19th. The three ex-Beatles did the closest thing they could to performing with Lennon. They completed a song he was writing before he died and recorded with a tape of Lennon singing it. To coincide with the TV broadcast, several CDs of Beatles outtakes will be released beginning this month. I spoke with Ringo Starr last June about his life before, during, and after the Beatles. He's made 11 albums since the Beatles broke up. I asked him first how he, Harrison, and McCartney reunited for the documentary.
This thing's been put together. It was first put together in 1970. A long time ago. And so that, you know, we finally threw Apple and Neil Aspinall, a good friend of ours, you know, we finally put it together, but it needed something new instead of it just being like the documentary. And so we all decided to be involved ourselves. So we are interviewed also to give our side of the story. And so the follow-on for that was we were all interviewed separately. And then, of course, we decided we'd be interviewed together. And the follow-on to that was, well, why don't we make some music for it? And the problem we had with that, well, yes, it's really easy that Paul, George, and Ringo can go in the studio and make this music, but that's not the Beatles. So we needed something that, you know, it would still be the Beatles. And Yoko came up with a couple of tracks of John's that have never been out there, just demos, really. So we really worked on them to get them, you know, clean enough and usable enough, really. And we put them down on 24-track, and then we all worked with that. So it just seemed like, you know, it's a natural progression. We're all loose enough to do this together now. And it made it real easy because now John's in it.
Through the demo?
Through the tape, yeah.
What was it like playing together again?
It was very emotional. I mean, it was very emotional, first of all, listening to John on the tape. You know, because he is not here, but his voice was there. And then, you know, we had to, you know, we all called each other and spoke about it. You know, we had to say, okay, well, are we going to do this? You know, it's pretty strange. And we came to the conclusion that, well, what we'll do is we'll just feel, you know, we'll just sort of say, well, John's gone on holiday for a while or he's gone for a cup of tea. And that's how we got into it. So it felt okay, you know. But we still have the difficulty of, you know, the three of us doing anything. So it was a lifesaver, really.
Were there emotional things that had stood in the way of the three of you performing before?
Yes, we were all angry with each other.
Was it over money or music or personality?
It was over personality, it was over lifestyles, it was over, you know, a million different things over the years that, you know, we all like the family that have good years and bad years, and we just had quite a few bad years lately. But that's all sort of broken down now where, you know, the first time the three of us got together to actually do the music was very strange. You know, it was all like, here we are. But, you know, 20 minutes in, it was cool. We were laughing. We were having fun.
Did you all fall into some of the same patterns that you used to?
Sure, we all sort of have our personalities, you know, our own personalities, but we also have our personalities within the group. And they sort of started coming out and showing themselves again.
But I mean, it's been like 25 years, so your personalities have all changed a little.
Oh, yeah. Yes, but, you know, it's still when you put that combination together, you get a similar attitude. Mm-hmm. And we know each other so well. I mean, we were so close, you know, through the 60s and through the 70s and 80s. It wasn't like we never spoke to each other or we never met. We just had never worked together. So over the last 3 years, we've been working together on and off. So, you know, the ice was melting really fast.
There's a box set of Beatles recordings that were made at the BBC in the 1960s when you were regular guests on a radio show.
Yeah.
Do you have a favorite track from that we can play?
Baby, It's You. Is that on there?
Yes.
Well, why don't you play that one?
Why'd you choose it?
I choose it because it's really a smooth track. I'm trying to drag up my memory of all those tracks because there's like 50 of them on the record. And I felt that one was really smooth and, you know, it was real easy and it sounded great.
Okay.
Tears me apart. Well, many, many, many nights roll by. I sit alone at home and I cry over you. What can I do? Can't help myself. 'Cause baby, it's you. Baby, it's you.
Oh, my guest is Ringo Starr. Can we talk a little bit about life before the Beatles?
Sure.
Well, you grew up in Liverpool. What was your neighborhood like?
Well, I was born at a very early age.
Yeah, right.
My neighborhood was real working class. I remember being conscious from a very early age that I wanted to get out of there because it was dark. It was just dark. It was just a dark neighborhood, you know. It was like, they needed more streetlights at night. But, of course, it was my neighborhood as a child, and I have, you know, wonderful memories of it. And the thrilling thing is that, you know, my memory of it, because I'd left it for years, was like, you know, this childhood memory that I had all these big avenues that we used to walk down. And then I went back, and there's all these really narrow streets. So the memory plays games. But it was a loving neighborhood. I mean, the school was 3 minutes walk away, so, you know, it was a real neighborhood. There was a pub on nearly every corner, which I got to a little later. you know, and that, there was a park I used to walk to. One of my ambitions, which my mother used to tell me often, was I wanted to be a tramp. And so we used to walk everywhere. One of the reasons was, of course, because we couldn't afford to take a car or take a limo in those days. Or a bus even, so I used to walk a lot, and I used to love that. And there was parks around us, so it was a very poor neighborhood, but childhood memories make it quite romantic.
My guest is Ringo Starr. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Back with Ringo Starr. I know your father left the family, I think, when you were three.
Yeah, he'd had enough.
So did your mother have a way of making money?
Yeah, she worked any job she could find. You know, I mean, I come from a working class family, but they call it lower working class when you've only got one parent. But my mother, God bless her, she did anything from scrubbing steps to working in a fruit shop to working in pubs, anything she could to support us, because he forgot that part of the bargain.
Right. Mm. Now, I know when you were young, you had two long hospital stays.
Mm-hmm.
When you were six, your appendix burst and
yeah. You
ended up getting an internal infection.
Peritonitis, it's called, yeah. So that was pretty dangerous. It's still dangerous today, but in 1947, it was very dangerous.
So you were in the hospital for about a year.
I was in a year because 6 months in, I was getting rather well, and I got excited, and I fell out the bed.
Oh, no.
And ripped open all these stitches in my stomach, so they had to dive in again and sew me up.
Oh, gosh.
So we're lucky to be here, Terry.
Yeah. Well, then you got sick again when you were 13.
I know.
Well, tuberculosis, was it?
Yeah, but that was from the area I lived in.
Industrial stuff?
Where I lived, like, not every other home, but it was like, you know, six or seven cases in every street where people were just in the living room dying of TB because they didn't have a cure, of course. Mm. And again, God, you know, shone his light on me. In 1953 or 54, when they discovered streptomycin, and that's what saved me. So they shipped me off to a greenhouse in the country.
A greenhouse? Is it like a sanitarium?
Yeah, just a huge greenhouse where instead of flowers, they put all his kids in there and let us breathe some decent air for a change and gave us streptomycin. And a year later, I came out of there.
So how did you keep busy while you were sick? Had music entered your life yet? Were you listening to a lot of it?
That's where it entered my life, was because to keep us busy, besides letting us knit, they used to let us knit dishcloths.
Oh, wow.
It was really exciting.
Yeah.
And then, some teacher would come in with musical instruments, being drums, tambourines, maracas, triangles, all percussive stuff. And she'd put this big screen. I'm trying to let you visualize it out there, Radio Land. Big white paper with red notes for the drums, and yellow notes for the tambourines, and green notes for the triangles. And so she would point to these different colored symbols, and we would either hit whatever instrument we had. Well, I had a drum the first session, and and I really loved it, and so they came back like a couple of weeks later and they tried to give me another instrument, but I only wanted the drum, and that's where I really fell in love with drums.
So what was it like for you after you were sick or while you were sick, to be playing an instrument that's so physically taxing?
Well, I didn't have an instrument for years later. I made my first kit when I came out of hospital out of biscuit tins and firewood. And then when I was about 16, I got a bass drum. That's all I had, was a big bass drum. And then when I was 18, I got my first kit. So I'd strengthened up by then.
And how old were you when you were actually playing in a band?
1 month later.
After you got the kit?
Yeah. Because I was really lucky, because in those days, if you had the instrument, you were in the band. And because it was skiffle, so it was real easy. So that's how the guy next door, was called Eddie Miles, but we formed the Eddie Clayton Skiffle Group, and he was the guitarist, and my best friend Roy Trafford was the other guitarist, and we got another guy on T-chess bass, and we just went out there and played.
Now, when did you start playing rock and roll?
Very soon afterwards, I left that band, joined another skiffle group, and then I joined a rock and roll band called Rory Storm and the Hurricanes. And we were still sort of folky rock, and Johnny Guitar, our guitarist, we were playing the famous Cavern Club in Liverpool, and he brought a radio in to plug into. And, you know, you can imagine the size of your speaker on a radio. And he plugged into that and they threw us off because we were playing rock and roll. As we should have just been playing skiffle and folk blues. So, and then it started. We just went from there and everyone got amplifiers, of course. And we were off.
Ringo Starr, he'll be back with us in the second half of our show to talk about the Beatles. You can see Ringo reunited with George Harrison and Paul McCartney later this month on ABC TV on the documentary The Beatles Anthology. This is Fresh Air. This is Public Radio's National Fundraising Week, a perfect opportunity to remind you of how important public radio has become in disseminating the best of pop culture. Where would the Beatles be if it weren't for public radio? Okay, maybe that's not a very good example. On the other hand, it is pretty refreshing to hear Ringo Starr in a public radio setting, don't you think? Just a straightforward conversation, none of the celebrity hype. Call and support public radio. When it comes to the arts and popular culture, we bring you the famous and the emerging, the familiar and the new. Please make a pledge. Thanks. We'll get back to our interview with Ringo Starr a little later. This week, we're featuring a special series on American cities that gave us rock and roll. Today, our rock historian, Ed Ward, looks at New York. Although New York is a media capital, its rock and roll heritage was slow getting started.
If we're taking the history of the cities that gave America rock and roll in chronological order, it seems very odd to leave New York until last. But in fact, New York for many years wasn't a place where things started. True, it was America's post-war center of entertainment, but it also had a great stumbling block imposed by the New York Police Department. The media, of course, helped expose rock and roll. Alan Freed, the great disc jockey who put rock and roll on the map for white American teenagers, joined the staff of WINS in New York in 1954, and that helped shape tastes. And uptown in Harlem, the vocal group sound had one of its great capitals.
I'm through with my own love. I loved her through and through. I'm searching for a new love. Can that new love be? Kind of love. I love to laugh and suddenly lie. I'm glad to know it's more.
Winnie Winfield in the Harptones epitomized that sound, ably assisted by a man named Raul J. Sita, an arranger and producer whose ideas shaped the whole era thanks to his close association with several of the city's record labels. George Goldner, too, understood this music and made scores of classic records that Freed played on his show. Chantel's Maybe, with Sita's rolling piano moving it along, was typical, except, of course, that the singers were teenage girls, not teenage boys. Another important figure in Harlem was Bobby Robinson, a record store owner who paid attention to the rural blacks, who made up a significant portion of the area's residents. Robinson had a golden touch, recording bluesmen like Elmore James and Buster Brown, and vocal groups like the very young Gladys Knight and the Pips.
In every beat of my heart, there's a beat for you. In every toast of wine, there's a toast for you.
what helps music evolve is live performance, and this was extremely difficult in New York. To perform, one had to have a cabaret card issued by the police, and the slightest infraction could get it suspended or canceled. The great jazz pianist, Thelonious Monk, for instance, was arrested in a car in which narcotics were found. They weren't his, but he was never allowed to perform in New York again. The cards were also expensive, which deterred many one-shot performers from getting them. Thus, by the 60s, New York was moribund. The post-Beatles rock era virtually passed it by, with the polar exceptions of the Velvet Underground and the Love and Spoonful. But since only a few Greenwich Village coffee houses featured that kind of music, New York's major contribution to that era was the circle of folk singers that gave us Bob Dylan. The cabaret card law was finally reformed, but not before the music scene had all but fled the city. It wasn't until the mid-70s that something happened.
Hey!
The downtown scene actually started at the Mercer Arts Center, where the New York Dolls and Kiss got their start, but before long it had migrated to a bar on the Bowery called CBGB, where bands like the Ramones, Talking Heads, and Television redefined simplicity. Punk rock, named by New York critic Billy Altman, swept overseas, where the New York Dolls' last manager, Malcolm McLaren, took the sound and gave us back the Sex Pistols. Almost simultaneously, things were changing uptown, too. Jamaican immigrants had revolutionized the discos with an old trick from back home, talking over instrumental tracks.
Yves Saint Laurent, Pierre Cardin, the Chandlers, Cobies, and the Carringtons. Styles, not Gucci or Louis Vuitton, imported straight from the Bronx, and my name's the Bomb. Creole with a few words I like to voice, and arsenal arouses my particular choice. Got style and finesse, and I'm sure you'll agree, nobody ever, never, ever rhymed quite like me.
Rap was derided as a novelty, not really music, but like punk, it's proven too durable to go away. Like a horse that falls back after a promising start, then surges its way to the front at the finish, New York has come back, big time.
Ed Ward is Fresh Air's rock historian. He's currently living in Berlin. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, what it was like to play in the most popular bands in the world and not be able to hear yourself over the screaming crowd. We continue our conversation with Ringo Starr.
And all I gotta do is act naturally. Well, I bet you I'm gonna be a big star. Might win an Oscar, you can't never tell. The movie's gonna make me a big star. Cause I can play the part so well. Well, I hope you'll come and see me in the movies. Then I'll know that you will plainly see the biggest fool that ever hit the big time. And all I gotta do is act now.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Crown, publisher of Pavarotti, My World, a memoir by Luciano Pavarotti and William Wright. Celebrating 25 years of radio excellence, this is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross with part two of our interview with Ringo Starr. You can see him later this month, reunited with Paul McCartney and George Harrison on a three-part Beatles documentary that will be broadcast on ABC TV. When I spoke with Ringo last June, we talked about the early days of the Beatles. Here's an early song featured on the recent CD, The Beatles Live at the BBC. So how did the Beatles ask you to join the band after they asked Pete Best to leave it?
Well, they didn't do it that way, you see. Pete Best was still in the band, and I was with Rory.
Mm-hmm.
And one day, Pete couldn't make the session, so they asked me to play. And we'd got to know each other in Germany because we were the two bands playing there, the Beatles and Rory Storm. So, you know, we really became friends there. Then we kept back to Liverpool, and Pete couldn't make it one day, and Brian Epstein came and said, would you play the lunchtime session? Well, I said, sure. And that was it. And then we went for a drink, and that was the end of the story. And then a couple of weeks later, he asked me again to play a couple of sessions, a couple of gigs. And I said, sure, you know, because I just happened to have the time. And then I went away to play with Rory to a holiday camp in England, Butlin's Holiday Camp, where you go for 3 months, you play the summer there in the Rock and Calypso Hall, and we were the rock band, and Brian called me on the phone, and he said, you know, would you like to join the Beatles? Well, I said, sure, I'd love to join the Beatles, and I said, when? And he said, today. And I said, well, I can't join today. That was a Wednesday in 1962, and I said, I can't play today because, you know, the band would be out of a job. We'd have to wait till Saturday because by then we could get another drummer. And that's what happened. And, you know, everybody knows the story from then on.
Well, an interesting part of the story is that you showed up for the first recording session.
Oh, yeah.
Of the Beatles. And the producer,
George Martin.
Yeah, had another drummer all picked out because I guess he didn't know that you had been chosen to be in the band.
No, he didn't know. Well, he listened to the band with Pete Best and didn't think Pete was going to be on the session, and so he didn't know about me at all. And so he'd got this drummer, Andy White, ready, you know, a professional drummer, a session drummer. And I came down, and I was just mortified. And he said, oh, we've got this real drummer here. I thought, what am I? And he didn't want to take a chance, because in those days, it wasn't like you could go in the studio and just spend your time there. You know, the session was 3 hours. You were in and out. And that was it. So Andy played on the single, and of course, then we re-recorded it, and I played on the album. And I sort of defy anyone to tell the difference. And that was it. But George Martin has apologized over and over again because I've made him for doing this to me.
Yes, actually, I think he continues the apologies in his new book.
I think he does. Yeah. And he did on Friday when I was with him.
So
I always remind him.
What did you think the Beatles' chances were of really making it? What was your assessment of the band when you joined it?
I joined the band because they were the best band I'd heard. And that was how I played. I moved my career through Liverpool, of course, to, you know, if I could get into a better band, I would. And that's how I did it. You know, my aim was to play with good players. And that's what I did. I mean, the aim was not really to, you know, be big and famous. It was just to play with really good people.
Did you change your sound when you joined the Beatles?
No. That's why they wanted me to play, because of the way I could play.
So when you joined the band, did you have to do, you know, the Beatles haircut and the suit jacket?
Well, that's the famous line, you know, John came on the phone saying, welcome to the band, but you'll have to get your hair cut and get rid of your beard, and which I did. I didn't have much of a beard then, but I did have my hair swept back, and we had it cut so it fell forward. It was part of the image, and Brian Epstein was moving them into, like, this image thing too, making them wear suits and, you know, not drinking and smoking on stage. So it was all part of the deal.
Did that come easy for you? Were you comfortable with that? Or?
Oh, yeah, because I'd been in a group that had suits. You know, Rory, Storm and the Hurricane, we were the top band in Liverpool because we had suits. And, you know, everyone else was just in, like they are now, actually, all sort of scruffed up. But we were professionals. So, you know, it's all funny to think about it now, but that red suit meant so much.
Red, wow.
Red, and we had green suits, so we could change. Big doings in the 60s, I'll tell you, big doings.
No, in the Beatles, did you have to, like, figure out who you were going to be in terms of your public personality in the band? Because everybody in the band seemed to get this, you know, public persona.
Yeah, I think mine just came in naturally as Mr. Dopey. You know, it's sort of like the comic clown, you know? John had their edge. Paul was Mr. Lovable. Well, I was Mr. Lovable, but the young girls loved him. George was this silent type, and, you know, I was, hi, what's happening? And so that image, of course, especially through Hard Day's Night, is, you know, I've had to battle that since that day. Everybody thinks, oh, that's what he's like. And, of course, he's not like that at all.
Can you give us a sense of what it was like early on when the Beatles' fame started getting, like, so extraordinary that you couldn't go places without attracting crowds? I mean,
well, you know, we were young boys and it was exciting where we, you know, we'd sort of conquered England. That was the first job, you know, just to get down to London and get in there was heavy enough. And then we'd do the continent. You know, we used to have this saying, oh, well, we've done Sweden, we've conquered Sweden, we've done France now, we've done Italy, you know. And then, of course, we were invited to come to America, and at that time we were really worried because we'd had two records out here, or they were coming out, nobody wanted them. And by chance George came over for a holiday. He was the first one of us to come to America, and of course he was going into record shops saying, oh, have you got the Beatles? And they were saying, excuse me, never heard of them. So, you know, he came back saying, oh, they don't know us over there. And of course, you know, the story goes, when Capitol decided to put some money behind us to promote us, and we got off the plane to do Ed Sullivan, we had a number one. I mean, you know, you can't plan things like that. This is just how it is.
Well, that first Ed Sullivan performance is one of the watershed moments in rock and roll history. What are some of your memories of
Ed Sullivan?
Of that show?
Well,
yeah.
Ed, you see, I thought, we come to America, and it was fabulous, and there was millions of people at the airport, and they were lying in the streets, and it was, yeah, all over the place. And just my mind, I have of Ed to this day, and I don't know if it's actually true, but my impression was Ed Sullivan. You know, I'm waiting for Ed to say, yeah, they are, they're all the way from England, and it's great, and they're going to be fabulous, and blah, 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 blah. And it's like Ed said, here they are, the Beatles.
Well, you probably couldn't
just
comprehend,
like, thrown,
the whole... Yeah.
Thrown to the lions. Right. So to this day, I've always thought, God, I mean, we could have done better than that, Ed.
Well, you probably were unfamiliar with the whole Ed Sullivan phenomenon. I mean, the most
low-key,
square person.
You know, we did not know what it meant. You know, this guy just booked us on a show. We'd go anywhere for a gig.
So when girls started screaming at your performances, did you have any idea what was going on? Like, why the screaming as opposed to anything else?
It started in Liverpool, mm-hmm. and just.
So you actually knew where it started.
Oh, I mean, it caught on like wildfire all over the world.
Was it frustrating to perform in concerts where you couldn't hear what you were playing because the audience was screaming so loudly?
It got frustrating in the end. At the beginning, it was just fabulous. I mean, you know, if you can imagine, you're 22, 23, and you go on stage, and all those people are just screaming at you, loving you. I mean, you know, you were making a lot of records and making good records. You know, it was everything you dreamed of. And it just built up and built up. And, of course, around about 65, you know, it started actually to get a little tiring because
you know, we were starting to make really interesting records, and we couldn't perform them. And it didn't matter what we did, people were screaming anyway, so no one was listening. And because of that, we were becoming, you know, not the best musicians we would become, because we could only play, you know, the actual thing. I mean, for me personally, I, you know, it's very hard to do this on radio, but I could only do the downbeat, you know, check, 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 check. I couldn't do any fills or anything, because they would just disappear into the, you know, into the cosmos. So you found yourself, you know, you're just sitting there playing the track, really.
Ringo Starr is my guest. He'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with my guest Ringo Starr. Do you have a favorite phase of the Beatles' recording years?
I think, well, you see, the very first record, you know, making the first records was just a thrill. I mean, it was absolutely thrilling, and listening to it on the radio, you know, we would stop the car when we'd be going to a gig somewhere, and you'd know, you know, because they didn't play them every 10 minutes. Oh, it's 7:45 on Wednesday, they're going to play your record. And so wherever we were going, we'd stop the car. We're usually in a car and listen to it. And the other thing we did, if it moved up the charts, we would always have a celebratory dinner. So if you look at Beatle photos and Beatle footage, you'd see them getting fatter and fatter and fatter as they were getting more popular, because now we could afford food, you know. But and then, of course, from Rubber Soul on, you know, the records started to really get exciting. Or, you know, the sound, we were really getting into the sound, making sounds, making good sounds. The writing was getting better. You know, everything was picking up. It was really getting good. So, you know, it had a natural progression. So, you know, to say this period or that period, they're all different periods. I mean, I like the White Album. That's one of my favorites, just because I felt after Sgt. Pepper, which was brilliant, but it just doesn't happen to be my favorite. The White Album, we were getting back to being a band again. And, you know, that's what the Beatles were. We were a really cool band.
Being a band as opposed to being artfully produced in the studio, is that
sure,
what you mean?
Sure, even though we did it ourselves, you know, suddenly the strings and the brass were taking the center stage around the songs instead of the group.
Is there a track that you like best for your own work? I'd like...
Well, if you want to play an early Beatle track, you can always play Rain.
Why don't we do that?
Why not?
My guest is Ringo Starr. It's something else about the Beatles. You know, the Beatles were such an important part of music, life. Period, you know. And they're really a very small part in your life. I mean, a big part in who you are, but a small sure. part in the number of years
sure.
that you were a Beatle. Yeah. So I guess I'd like to get a sense of what it means in your life if you still feel like that is so much a part of your existence, or if that's something that you've really tried to move beyond and away from. And
well, I don't think you can move away from it, because you know, it was only 8 years of my life, but it's the 8 years that everybody really associates with. You know, it's like, you know, it doesn't matter. I've made hit records and you know, I had hit albums and I'm on tour and that. It always comes back to these 8 years of being a Beatle, and I think I just have to resign myself to that, that's what people want to know about. But of course, in my life, I've moved on, you know. I've done other things. You know, Barbara and I have been together for 15 years, you know, been married 14. So, you know, the love of my life, who's here with me today, listeners. You know, we have our life, we live together. But, you know, whenever it comes down to something like this, it's always a Beatle program.
Did you want the group to break up? Were you ready for it?
I think we were all ready in a way, because it wasn't as much fun as it used to be. It was okay while we got in the studio for a while, and then, you know, there would be some bickering. And nobody wanted to put in the time, including myself. You know, no one wanted to put in the time and energy that it took later on. You know, we may have done the first album in 12 hours, but the last ones were taking months. And, you know, no one really wanted to put in that time and energy. So it was sort of just like a natural falling apart, really.
I know you've been sober since 1988.
Mm-hmm. I am still sober today.
Did you have alcohol or drug problems for much of your career before that?
Well, it didn't seem to be a problem in those days. Though, you know, you're younger and you can recoup real easy and it, you know, I did use and abuse even in those days, but it wasn't on a daily basis. It just sort of caught up with me from sort of 1975, I believe. That's where my real downhill roll started. And, you know, it just got faster and faster and worse, and, you know, blackouts and passouts. And found yourself, you couldn't really handle the day unless you had something change in your attitude, you know, alcohol or drugs of any description. And in the end, it just got so scary and painful and frightening that, you know, I hit my bottom just terrified, and just, you know, God's will and Barbara's got us into a rehab, because I didn't know you did that. And but I was frightened enough to ask, you better get us in one of those places. And that's what she did. And from since then, you know, thanks to them, thanks be to God, I haven't had a drug or a drink on a daily basis.
Now, I know your son plays with you in your band.
Mm-hmm.
Do you, like, watch him when
Yeah,
when
watch
you're on
him.
The road?
Watch his every move, the little whippersnapper. No, it's I don't watch him. He's a really fabulous player. And what is just exciting, it's like, you know, I'm not looking at him all the time, but I just turn around and look over, and there he is. And you've got your son. I mean, it's just an absolute thrill that he's up there with you, you know. And it just goes to prove that, you know, you give him one lesson and watch out. They're up there with you.
So he plays
drums.
So he plays your instrument.
Yeah, and my.
Are you flattered that he plays the same instrument you do? You know, some kids will do anything to not do what their parents did.
Sure. No, he's always been a drummer since he was a baby. He's always been a drummer, but he also plays good piano and good guitar. But the interesting thing with our family is he plays drums, and so does his brother, who's another drummer. So we are the family drummers, you know.
Ringo Starr, recorded last June. The documentary, The Beatles Anthology, will be broadcast over 3 nights on ABC TV beginning November 19th. This is Fresh Air. This is Public Radio's National Fundraising Week, a perfect opportunity to reminisce with you about the days when I was known as the fifth Beatle. Wait a minute, that wasn't me, that was somebody else. But you can trust me on this. We need you to call with a pledge. Thank you. Sigourney Weaver and Holly Hunter team up in the new film Copycat, about a psycho who copycats the styles of famous serial killers. Guest critic Steve Weinberg has this review.
The new thriller Copycat, which opened in theaters just in time for Halloween, is too frightening to be shaken off with a laugh when you leave the theater. All week I've had images in my head of the boyish serial killer, played by William McNamara, who emulates the techniques of celebrated modern murderers, and of the grisly messages he sends out on the internet to the author of a famous book on serial killers, played by Sigourney Weaver, whom he's aching to impress. The director, John Emil, has too much tact to dwell on the actual murders. Copycat isn't a gross-out, and the plot details didn't make me want to throw up, as they did in the recent movie Seven. The movie doesn't need to be graphic to lay siege to our fears. Brian De Palma glided through this psychic territory in glittering, multi-toned movies like Dress to Kill. Emil doesn't have De Palma's elegance or wit, or his depth of emotion. What he has is a talent for working with actors, and a script by Ann Biederman and J. Preston Allen that's as unpredictable as a snapped whip. Sigourney Weaver plays a psychologist whose expert testimony has put one serial killer, Harry Connick Jr., away. When he escapes, stalking and nearly killing her, she suffers a breakdown. Agoraphobia confines her to her San Francisco apartment for more than a year. Her only social contacts are via the internet. She boozes and pops Valium to still her panic attacks. But three local murders, executed in the style of Boston Strangler, both reawaken her terror, even though Connick is finally safely behind bars, and tease out her buried intellectual interest in serial killers. She ends up in a reluctant collaboration with the two cops on the case, Holly Hunter and Dermot Mulroney. It's Weaver who identifies the shift in the killer's M.O. when a fourth body turns up.
There were two kinds of sperm. They said one was a secretor and the other was not.
How'd you know about that?
There were needle marks on her right arm.
So far, nothing they test for comes up positive.
Was the body found near a no dumping sign?
Yes.
Like this?
I could have taken that picture this morning.
He switched from DeSalvo to Bianchi and Buono, the hillside strangler. Two men, two kinds of sperm. Very witty, our guy.
Well, but you said that they're like robots. That is not consistent with what you had.
Consistency is the hobgoblin of small minds. Tells me to test for the chemicals found in window cleaner, ammonia, ethanol.
I know window cleaner. I know.
It's what they injected into one of their victims.
Why these guys? And why in such detail?
He wants to dazzle us. I mean, anyone can strangle someone in a bathtub, right? He's just saying, look out. I'm just getting started.
The cast is terrific, except for Connick, who lacks the skills to bring off the lunatic hillbilly performance Emil is coaxing him to give. He's over the top. Holly Hunter slips into the role of a sharp-witted homicide cop. She seems effortlessly at home in this nerve-jangling environment. Her comfortable rapport with Dermot Mulroney teeters on the edge of romantic comedy. Sigourney Weaver does an amazing turn as the freaked-out psychologist. Weaver may be the most daring of American actresses. 10 minutes into the movie, she's already locked inside this character's panic, and she starts from there, taking her performance right into the stratosphere. There's an expendable subplot involving a jealous ex-lover of Hunter's, a fellow cop. And it's a mistake when the filmmakers, on three separate occasions, manipulate our feelings for the characters for the sake of a plot point or a shock effect. As an audience at a thriller, we give ourselves up willingly to be electroshocked. But a filmmaker has to be wary of breaking faith with us. Luckily, for almost all of Copycat, we're on the movie's side.
Steve Weinberg writes for the Boston Phoenix and teaches at College of the Holy Cross. Well, since singer and pianist Harry Connick plays a psycho in Copycat, let's hear Connick in a more reflective mode from his album 20. This is a duet with Carmen McRae, who has since passed away. The song is Please Don't Talk About Me When I'm Gone.
About me when I'm gone. Although our friendship ceases from now on.
And Carmen, if you can't say anything real nice, but baby, it's better not to talk at all. That's my advice.
We are partying, you go your way, I'll go mine. It's best that we do. Here's a little kiss. I hope that this brings lots of luck to you.
Makes no difference how I carry on. 'Cause baby, I know that you better not talk about me when I'm gone. Oh.
Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, and Phyllis Myers, with Alan Tu and Nancy Updike. Research assistance from Rena Bander. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.